We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is Adam Hamilton, founder of ZLLC.com. Adam, thanks for joining me again.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me. Great to see you.
Great to see you, too. You know, it's been a little bit since we've spoken, but it's always great to speak with you because you're such an in-depth gold researcher. And, you know, gold has really been on a tear here. We're speaking on the afternoon of April 1st, just after gold hit another overnight high of 2281, a new all-time high, and right on the start of the new quarter here. So I want to get your take on how much of this rally that we have seen so far this year is driven by the traditional spring seasonality here.
Oh, that's a great question, Tom. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun in Goldland for a change. As you and your viewers know, it's been a long time since we've gotten some love, so it's great to see capital flowing in. This gold upleg is really unique, Tom. It's really strange, really different. I've been doing this for almost 25 years now, and usually there's a three-stage process for gold uplegs. They start with gold futures short covering in the American futures markets. After that, there's gold futures long buying, which is about twice as large as the short covering. And then you get stage three investment buying ultimately. And gold investment buying is only reported definitively four times a year, quarterly, by the World Gold Council. It publishes these amazing reports called Gold Demand Trends Reports that just detail global gold supply and demand, flow of funds, that kind of thing. And the best proxy for that quarterly investment data is the combined holdings, the GLD and IAU gold ETFs, the two giant American gold ETFs, which are also the largest gold ETFs in the world by far. They dominate the whole global gold ETF scene. But this upleg is remarkable because we've seen zero, like literally no demand from the major American gold ETFs. So American stock investors, at least, aren't the least bit interested in gold. Yet we have these record highs, as you alluded to. We had a streak in early March, like 9 days in a row of record highs. We got more record highs going into early April here. It's really exciting, and it's great to see the demand coming from somewhere else than American stock investors. And it's really exciting. I think the American stock investors will come too. So it's just awesome to see this happen without them so far. It's amazing.
So Adam, how do we separate, let's say, this typical seasonality from years past to this year? Is there a way to understand it divorced from, you know, physical demand? Is that seasonality just a typical thing?
Spring is always a strong season for gold, Tom. There's three big seasonal rallies of the year, autumn, winter, and spring. And spring is actually the smallest seasonal rally for gold. And I think the reason is because autumn and winter seasonal rallies, the drivers are well known and they're big coming from Asia. Like, for instance, there's Asian harvest season at the end of summer. Farmers figure out what kind of surplus income they have after they harvested their crops. They buy gold. Then there's Indian wedding season going into late autumn, into winter, you know, the big festivals in India when it's auspicious to get married. Then there's year-end buying in like December and January after American and Western investors forget how much surplus income they owned after bonuses and salaries. Then there's Chinese New Year. So the winter and autumn rallies are really well understood, but there's a gold spring rally, the weakest of the year. And I think that's just due to optimism. You know, the days get longer in the Northern Hemisphere where most of the world's traders are. There's more sunlight, more warmth. We all love summer, the vacation season, the travel season. The stock markets go up in the spring. They have strong seasonality here. For whatever reason, gold rallies, and the gold stocks have one of their best seasonal rallies of the year, the best leverage to gold out of all the seasonal rallies in the spring rally. Mm-hmm. And so the spring rally isn't really well understood, but I think it's a tailwind. It's not a primary driver. The primary drivers of gold are fundamentals, technicals, and sentiment. Mm-hmm. And so I think this year's rally, though it's happening in spring, is totally divorced from normal seasonals, Tom. It's too big, too interesting, too many cross currents, too many things happening that are atypical, such as Chinese retail buying, such as central bank buying. And so I think seasonals are a small part of this. It's a nice tailwind, but it's not mm-hmm. driving it by any means.
Excellent. Well, Adam, you mentioned the mining stocks. Are they starting to catch the same wave now as well?
Starting, but just barely starting. I mean, the gold stocks are so low compared to where gold is relatively. You know, you talked about 2280 this morning. Let's just call it 2250 for discussion's sake. Mm-hmm. You know, the main gold stock index in the United States or ETF is GDX, of course. And that's at like $32 as we do this interview. And it was like $41 back in March 2022 or so before the US dollar went stratospheric on the Fed's aggressive rate hikes. Mm-hmm. And so gold stocks are just radically undervalued, just crazy undervalued. You know, back then gold was closer to 2000. And so people are starting to wake up to the fact gold's rallying, but it's not really widely understood yet. And so many people have been burned in gold stocks for so long, they're really hesitant to get back in. So we just need more momentum, more gold record highs, more streaks of such record highs, and people will start coming back in. But the opportunities are huge because right now the gold stock buying has been low, and gold stocks are still super, super undervalued relative to gold, relative to their underlying earnings. They have low priced earnings ratios, trailing 12 month. They're incredible bargains in this sector, despite gold being at record highs, which is really unusual as well.
So Adam, what do you think actually explains, let's say, these seasonal price moves in gold? Is it behavior because of sentiment?
You know, we humans are creatures of herd and habit. You know, we all have habits. We all have things that we do. We tend to follow the herd. The markets are a huge herd arena. You know, we see other people making money in something, and people want to just follow them in and rush in to chase up some momentum, the whole fear of missing out thing. Mm-hmm. And so the seasonals are really the herd and habit thing. You know, other people see gold railings. They decide to buy and just try to ride the upside. And the habit thing, you know, when gold's rallying, people want to buy, they see prices rallying. So sentiment's definitely a big factor of that, the seasonals for sure. But underlying it, it's true physical demand, like the whole Indian wedding season in the autumn, the Indian harvest before that, the Chinese New Year around February, late January. So there's real physical demand underlying these seasonals, except possibly for the spring rally. But that physical demand pushes gold up high enough to get sentiment moving, and then the exuberance starts coming and people start buying, and so that's the real driver, is the animal spirits.
Adam, are the seasons for the physical metal and the equities very different from each other?
That's a great question, Tom. No, they're not. They're very tightly correlated, but sometimes in some of these free rallies, autumn, winter, spring, the equities do better. They outperform gold, and some of the rallies, gold outperforms the equities. The equities don't leverage gold as much as they should. You know, for major gold stocks, the rule of thumb is like they should leverage gold moves by like 2 times to 3 times. Mm-hmm. Gold rallies 10%, you should get 20% to 30% out of the Huey Index or the GDX ETF. So some season rallies, you see that, but some you don't. And spring is the one that has the most upside leverage of gold stocks to gold. And it's huge. It's like 4.5 times or something, way beyond normal. So the spring effect, whatever it is, affects gold stocks way, way more than the metal itself.
Interesting. So Adam, is it possible that investors, you know, after seeing the price of gold run up like this, they don't want to chase it and they're starting to look at the undervalued equities instead?
It's possible. Certainly. Yeah. Investors love chasing upside momentum. I mean, that's their thing. They just love piling in. They get really infected by popular greed, euphoria, exuberance. And so it's hard for me to imagine them not wanting to chase gold the higher it goes. Mm-hmm. But when they see gold rally, they're going to start looking at peripheral things. You know, gold's up. What's going to benefit from gold? What are secondary or tertiary plays? What can leverage gold? What can go up higher than gold? How can I amplify this move? And so I don't think the gold buying will stop unless gold falls, you know, crashes, falls sharply, falls symmetrically to its recent rise. It doesn't need to crash. It's not that overbought yet. It is overbought, but not like dangerously so by past precedent. Mm-hmm. So I don't think gold's going to come down hard or anything. And I think as long as it doesn't, people want to buy gold. You know, one thing that really interests me, Tom, is gold investment. No one knows how much gold everybody has. You know, it's kind of an opaque market. It's hard to see what's going on there. Mm-hmm. But there's one kind of proxy I use for it. I look at the value of GLD plus IU holdings, those two giant American gold ETFs that dominate the world gold ETF space, just figure out how much money they have invested in gold. And they publish their holdings daily, so that data is available every day. Mm-hmm. Then I divide that by the total market capitalization of the 500 S&P 500 stocks in the US, which are a huge part of the markets, but not the entire stock markets. And that ratio has been running under 0.2% forever. So I think at least American stock investors have less than 0.2% of their capital allocated in gold. So if they want to chase this thing, what if they go to 0.5%? What if they go to 1%? You know, historically, a 5% to 10% allocation in gold has been considered reasonable and prudent for centuries. You know, there's just so much room to buy gold because everybody's so underinvested. So it has huge room to run, huge room for investors to chase it for a long, long time.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about what kind of demand that that would bring into the market, right? We know that price is set on the margins. So if our, let's say, typical demand side is way outstripped or out demanded, it would be really interesting to see what would actually happen to the price, because there isn't exactly all kinds of excess inventory that can be just thrown onto the market.
Yeah, it can't be created. That's the great thing about gold historically. That's why it's always been a great store of value, because the mining rate is inherently limited. You have this big, huge supply that's been mined over millennia, and you may be able to add 1% to it a year, probably less now. And so you can't inflate the supply for demand. And so as investment capital starts flooding into the sector, the price of gold can really go stratospheric. You know, we saw that in late 1979, early 1980. We could really have that kind of gold scenario play out again, which would just be phenomenal. And Tom, we talked about all-time record highs at the start of the show, and these are nominal record highs, not adjusted for inflation, of course. If you look at that January 1980 high, it's way higher. I don't know if it's 3,600 now, somewhere in there, somewhere north of 3,500 US. And so there's huge room to run, and there's so much more capital now than there was in 1980. One time I did a study, I looked at the global money supply growth between the big, like the US, the EU, Canada, some of the big countries in the world that publish that data, and looked at that since 1980 versus gold since 1980. Mm-hmm. And the value, the total amount of dollars, yuan, euros, whatever in circulation is vastly higher. It's gone up way bigger proportion than the amount of physical gold supply. So if we get a similar inflow of investment capital as we did back then, if the public really starts chasing gold, if it starts to be something that everybody wants to own for this fear of missing out thing, gold can just go to levels that few can even imagine. I have no projection for it. Just unbelievably high levels. So it's really exciting. Mm-hmm.
So Adam, do you think we can look to the, let's say, the bull market rally of 2016 as a small preview of what could happen this year?
That's really interesting. 2016 is really interesting. I'd kind of pull your attention to 2020 though instead, Tom. 2020 was really interesting because two major gold uplegs peaked that year, and they were two unique uplegs in that both uplegs had streaks of new nominal record highs. That's kind of unusual for gold, or it has been in recent years for gold to power up to new nominal record highs. And nominal record highs are really interesting because they garner a lot of financial media coverage. They make people who are not following gold, not contrarians, they see it on CNBC or Bloomberg, and they tend to see, the financial media loves covering new records. And so the more nominal record highs you have, the more financial media coverage you get. And that tends to be bullish because people are talking about record highs, gold rallied again, gold's up 1.5% today at 2280 this morning. And people see that and they want to buy, they want to chase it. They become aware of it. And so these uplegs that see new record high streaks are pretty special. In both those uplegs that peaked in 2020, they had huge gains, Tom. I call them monster uplegs. The first was like 40%, the second 42%. I think that's reversed. 42% was the earlier upleg, 40% the second upleg. And as of this past Thursday, Good Friday was a market holiday. As of this past Thursday, today's gold upleg was up 20%. And so this one could easily double, being the first streak, first gold upleg with record nominal high streaks since 2020. So I could easily see 40% gains in this upleg from the October bottom, which was like 1820-ish, I think. And so there's huge potential just in this upleg alone, not talking the bull or the broader inflows of investment capital. It's really, really bullish still.
Mm-hmm. How about from, let's say, a driver perspective, Adam? You know, 2016, we saw a bit of an interest rate cut, but, you know, this year so far, we haven't seen any cuts yet. So how do we think about the drivers for the gold price at this point as well?
Great question. You know, starting out, circling back to 2020 again, the driver for those giant monster uplegs was investment capital inflows, as evidenced in GLD and IAU holdings. Once again, these ETFs publish their holdings every single day, how much physical gold bullion they have. The way they work is they have to track gold. That's their mission, to track the price of gold. So if investors buy their shares faster than gold itself is being bought, the ETF shares will tend to, they will decouple from the gold's price to the upside. And that's unacceptable. That can't happen. That'd be a failure of their mission. So what their managers do is they issue enough new shares to keep pace with gold. And they use the proceeds from new shares to buy more physical gold bullion underneath their ETFs. Not all gold ETFs are physically backed. The World Gold Council makes that distinction. But the ones that are, they have to buy physical gold bullion in a vault somewhere to just keep their share price tracking gold itself. Mm-hmm. And so investment demand is the single biggest driver for major gold uplegs, major bull markets. And we're seeing that come out of China. The data from China is harder to quantify. There's some data, some customs data. It's not as clean or easy to parse as some of the Western data is. But we need to see Western demand. And I use GLD and I use a proxy, but I'm just talking Western investment demand in general. That's what's going to make this up leg huge and this bull market huge when investors start chasing it. When they start taking their 0.2% allocation up to 0.3, 0.4, 0.5, 1.0, that's what's going to be the main driver for this thing is investment demand. That's what always moves gold prices at the margin, because the rest of the physical market is fairly well balanced. You know, the actual gold for industrial uses, you know, central bank buying has been abnormally large lately, which is really interesting. Side note, but investment demand's the marginal driver that can just make for huge gold bulls and rallies and uplegs. So that's what I'm looking for, is big investment demand coming.
Interesting. So what are some of the market metrics that we can look at to understand the likely price action for a coming season or month?
Three things. They're kind of insider baseball again. They're the three stages of gold I alluded to. My market or my mission, Tom, has always been to understand what's going on in the markets, why, and how to trade it with specific stocks. And so I look at the cause and effect. Like, why does gold rally? Why does its price go up? And that's that gold futures short covering early in uplegs, gold futures long buying by speculators in the middle of uplegs, then investment buying late in uplegs. Those are the three things. The gold futures data, that's released once a week. It's current to Tuesday afternoons, but it's published late Friday afternoons in these reports called the Commitments of Traders reports that are pretty famous. They're kind of hard to parse. They're technical. They're not easy to look at until you get a feel for them. Mm-hmm. But and the next thing is investment demand. Whether you want to track GLD or IU, GLD and IU holdings or something else, or the World Gold Council's quarterly gold demand trends reports. Those are fantastic. Really easy to read. Just really well presented. Really well researched. Investment demand in gold futures buying is the main way to determine what's going to happen with the gold price. Now, circling back around to that, the stage one, again, of gold uplegs is gold futures short covering. And that all happens really fast, like within the first 6 weeks or so of a gold upleg. Mm-hmm. So from early October to, say, late November, most of the gold futures short covering already happened. And it's neat because the speculators who buy gold futures, if you look at their positioning over time, they tend to have secular trading ranges. And so gold futures shorts can only go so low or tend to only go so low, and speculator gold futures longs tend to only go so high. So shorts are down at their secular support, meaning there's not likely to be much more gold futures short covering by speculators. That part, the stage one buying is done essentially. But the stage two long buying is really exciting. At the last Commitments of Traders report, current to last Tuesday, the last Tuesday in March, the speculators had only done... they'd done 55% of their total potential buying from when this upleg started in early October at 1820 till now. So 45% of the probable buying for this upleg is still outstanding, Tom, which is huge. I mean, that means gold's up 20% with 55% of the buying plus the short covering. You know, what? How high could go with the remaining 45% before the stage three investment buying even starts? And so I track gold futures. I track the gold ETF holdings. And they've just been really, really useful over the years and had a really high correlation to gold prices, where they've been, where they're going. So that's what I'd recommend.
Yeah, it's really interesting to, let's say, consider investment demand and what that actually means. Adam, do you think we should break that out, let's say, into Western physical demand versus ETF demand? Like, how do we break that apart and think about it?
Absolutely. It definitely needs to be broken apart. Western demand's huge. Asian demand, foreign demand, European demand, and ETF demand is broken out as well. The World Gold Council does it like that. They have a physical category. They have bars and coins. And then they have an ETF category for ETF flows. ETF flows are crazy volatile. Like, if people don't like gold for some reason, if investors see gold fall, they'll sell ETF shares faster than gold itself is falling. So those ETFs will be forced to buy back their own shares to maintain that tracking we talked about. Mm-hmm. So they'll sell physical gold bullion to raise the cash to buy back their own shares. And so their holdings will fall. But yeah, those are the categories the World Gold Council uses, and that's the way to do it. I've been working on Chinese gold investment, trying to find better sources of data. And that data is just so fragmented. I wish there was an easy way to do that. And I hopefully can figure out something eventually here to track that. Some people are doing a good job at it, but just it's not reliable. It's not consistent. For instance, China's central bank, the People's Bank of China, they they publish their gold holdings monthly, but for long periods of time, they say they're not doing any gold buying. But the people who are experts in this, who track central bank flows, say the PBOC is buying and just decided not to report their purchases because they don't want to have traders front run them and have to pay a higher price. And so a lot of the data coming out of China is questionable. You know, maybe it's righteous, maybe not, but you can't know for sure. There was a time recently where the PBOC reported it hadn't done any gold buying for years. Then all of a sudden it had this massive spike, like call it 30-40% in 1 month. And there's no way it had that kind of inflows in 1 month, probably physically impossible with that much gold around. But so yeah, that Chinese, I wish we had better data from China. That would be really helpful to this whole investment discussion.
Kind of going back to the idea that you don't necessarily want to show your cards on the table, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely. If you're buying, you don't want to tell people you're buying until you're done buying. The moment you're done buying, you don't want to tell everybody you bought so they follow you in. Mm-hmm. But when you're actually accumulating positions in anything, any stock, you don't want anybody to know. I mean, that's just smart trading there. Mm-hmm. Kudos to the PBOC for realizing that.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, I think they're a lot better at strategic thinking and long-term thinking than many of our leaders in the West are.
With
Adam, does gold really get moving once we've got investment buying in the physical side? You know, something, if listeners remember, going back to my conversation 3 weeks or so ago with Bob Coleman and Steve St. Angelo, they brought up the fact that this physical buying from the retail investor really has not begun yet. So, you know, do you think that a lot of these investors, as you said before, just have shied away from this because this bull market has just taken every opportunity to kick them off before it actually got going?
It's been a tough few years in gold psychologically, for sure. It's been grinding higher on balance other than that mid-2022 thing where the US dollar went stratospheric on the steepest Fed rate hike cycle in history. You know, 475 basis point hikes in a row were part of that, the middle of that. But yeah, I think retail investment buying is huge, Tom. And I think it will move the gold price radically. You know, most of the main gold price is the American gold futures run, right? And that's a paper-based gold price. Like, it's kind of a fiction based on futures trading, buying and selling gold futures. The physical gold price disconnects from that. It fluctuates around that. But when people start buying physical in mass, they're going to push up those physical prices and people will start to take notice. The futures traders will start to take notice. They'll start chasing that. And there'll be reports of shortages. You know, gold's expensive, obviously. So most people, when they buy it, they choose 1 ounce national coins, rather maple leaves or double eagles or Krugerrands or whatever. And those coins will sell out pretty quick. There's not a huge supply of them once retail investors start getting interested in physical gold as opposed to ETF shares. Mm-hmm. And this, there'll be reports of shortages. They'll go to a coin dealer. They'll look on the web. We're sold out for the foreseeable future. We can't get these. The premiums are 20% over spot, 10%, whatever it's going to be. And this fear of missing out kind of dynamic will kick in. And people will just, they'll be like, oh my gosh, I can't buy gold anymore. What should I do? And I think that'll really push gold vertical fast. And so retail will be a huge part of that. Mm-hmm. The paper gold markets won't be able to handle big retail inflows in the physical gold. I mean, they're fine if it's ETF flows. The ETFs are buying the big 400 ounce delivery good bars, London Bullion Metal Exchange, things. So there's a lot of huge supply of those things. But as far as small retail investment, there's just not enough coins or small bars or anything to go around. That'll really drive the FOMO dynamic to this big time, I think.
Kind of on the other side of that, Adam, what sectors of the miners do you think will have the biggest gains?
Definitely the smaller stocks, Tom. The majors, I define majors as producing over 1 million ounces of gold a year. Yeah. Yeah, I think, and in my essays, I write 1,000K, so just making sure I'm parsing that right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the majors tend to, again, leverage gold by 2 to 3 times. They have large market capitalizations, and they have big production bases that are hard to grow. But the thing investors prize most in gold stocks is production growth, because that tends to lower your costs. It tends to up your profits. If you can produce more gold, there's more ounces to spread the big fixed costs of mining across, so your all-in sustaining costs fall. And so the smaller, the mid-tiers and the junior gold miners are the parts of this sector that are going to have the biggest gains by far. I define juniors as under 300K ounces a year. A mid-tier is 300K to 1,000K. And that's where I play. That's where I've invested and speculated for almost a quarter century now. They'll have the biggest gains by far. The better ones are able to consistently grow their production. they have a few great mines as opposed to the major stables of 10 plus where they might not be so great. There might be some higher cost ones in there. And so I'd totally recommend the mid tiers and maybe juniors if people are comfortable doing some research on them. Huge potential there.
So what are some of the fundamentals for that sector that stick out to you as the strongest right now? You know, the gold mining industry as a whole at this point seems to be really hated, but what are some of the fundamentals that you think most investors are missing?
The really interesting thing to me is the cost, Tom. You know, the profit of mining gold is your selling price minus your mining costs, and AISCs are probably the best proxy for that. And the all-in sustaining costs are rising way slower than the price of gold. Even before the last 6 or 8 weeks, they've been rising way slower than the price of gold. They are rising. You know, there's inflation. There's a lot more money in the world. Costs go up. They got to pay people more. But they've been rising slow compared to gold going up faster. And so the profit margin is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And the profits, it's not quite an exponential rise relative to the gold price, but it's definitely bigger than linear. And so the profits of these companies are just growing massively. And I don't think investors realize that. You know, there's plenty of mid-tier gold miners trading at single-digit trailing 12-month price to earnings ratios, and that's just crazy. You know, when gold stocks are in favor, people will pay 40, 50, 100 times for them. They don't care. They just want to own them. And right now, they're actually value stocks in this sector, lots of really good value stocks. And so I think the earnings growth are something people aren't really paying attention to yet, but I think they will as gold goes higher and they start to dig into this sector. And I think that'll be a huge impetus of especially professional buying, fund manager type buying. When they see the values in this sector and how their earnings are growing and how many quarters in a row their earnings have gone up by high double digits or even triple digits year over year, they're just going to be amazed and want to flood in to be a part of this sector.
So to counteract that, Adam, what fundamentals in the, let's say, the major indices are headwinds right now?
You talking the major gold stock indices, Tom, or the stock market?
Like the S&P, NASDAQ stock markets.
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think the single biggest reason that American Western investors haven't been buying gold is because there's a because the stock markets are shooting vertical almost. There's a bubble in the S&P 500. I define a bubble by the century and a quarter definition of that, of markets being over twice fair value in TTMPE terms. That's 28 times earnings is the bubble value. 14 times is the century and a half fair value. Mm-hmm. We're trading like at 33 times or so right now. So it's definitely a bubble. Mm-hmm. And so I think this whole thing, the whole AI bubble, the focus on NVIDIA and the tech stocks, mega cap tech soaring, I think that's really distracted people. You know, people see CNBC and to a lesser extent Bloomberg here. And all they talk about is tech stocks and all the money people are making and whether it's NVIDIA or Supermicro, the hot AI stocks. And they have no desire to like diversify their portfolios to consider alternative investments. And so gold, in my experience, has always tended to fare poorly when stock markets are really high and lofty. There's a lot of euphoria. I think that's the number one reason why Western investors haven't bought gold yet. So that's a huge headwind, just the euphoric sentiment of the stock markets, Tom. But that'll blow over. You know, stock markets don't go up forever. Stocks don't rally forever. Markets are cyclical. They flow and ebb. They go up and down. There's parabolic rises to bubbles, and the bubbles pop, and there's collapses and bear markets. And so sooner or later, maybe after the spring season with the strong seasonals, the S&P 500 is going to roll over, and then people will start looking for alternatives. Then they'll see gold's just making record after record and get really excited about it. But yeah, the stock market euphoria has been a huge, huge dampening just influence on gold investment, man, without a doubt. Probably the number one, in my opinion.
You know, when we think about ebbs and flows here, Adam, how do you see inflation going forward? I always, you know, want to get my guest take on this subject because it is something that is going to affect everything going forward and already does.
Oh, it's huge. In our household, I do a lot of the grocery shopping because I'm really a foodie. I really want good quality meat and produce. And my wife is like, she'll take anything. She doesn't check every like cut of beef or whatever, you know. So I go to Costco every week and buy food. And Costco is probably the cheapest place to buy decent quality food. It amazes me how the prices are going up. And so this inflation is a huge deal, and it's driven by increasing money supplies. The Fed upped the U.S. money supply, its balance sheet, by call it 115% or so in about 2 years after the March 2020 pandemic lockdown stock panic. Mm-hmm. And they've been taking some of that money out of the system, selling some of the treasuries and mortgage-backed securities that they monetized. But the money supply is still like 75% higher now than it was in February 2020 time in the United States. So this inflation is not going anywhere. You know, when you hear people on financial television talk about inflation, they're always like, well, inflation is the rate of increase in prices, which is technically true. But for consumers, people buying meat to feed their families, or we think of the absolute prices. We want to go back to like pre-pandemic price levels. And that's never going to happen as long as all this money's in the system. Mm-hmm. And the same is true for money creation in Europe, probably China. You know, it just, these higher prices are here to stay. And when people see that, I think they're going to look, they're going to consider how should I position my financial assets so I can protect myself from this inflation? When they see higher prices not fall, regardless of what the inflation metrics are reported by the government, they're going to be like, you know, maybe I need to diversify my assets, whether it's Bitcoin or gold or something that can't be created as fast as the money supplies. And so I think the inflation is a huge peripheral driver of investment demand going forward. And it's not going anywhere. It can't go away unless these money supplies are drained and the central banks aren't doing it, probably because it caused depression to pull all this new money out of the system.
Yeah, it's a great point that, you know, basically all of the other prices have to rise in a way in order to soak up all of the currency that was created.
Yeah. Yep. And, you know, the great economists in the past, like Friedman, they talked about, you know, prices are neutral. There's a currency and there's real goods and services in which to spend it. And the real goods and services will just, they'll normalize with the level of money in the system. And that hasn't happened yet, I don't think. Mm-hmm. You know, I look at the official US government's like food price thing. You know, Costco is my best example of food prices because I see it every week. And, you know, I think I'm paying 50% more for groceries, maybe 60% for a lot of things. But like the US CPI, it talks about like 25-30% rise in at-home food prices. So I think the real world inflation is way higher than what people are experiencing, way higher than what the government is saying we're experiencing. I think mm-hmm. that's really frustrating people. And I think more people are seeing that disconnect. We have middle school kids and get to go to a lot of social gatherings, basketball games. And I talk to people about inflation all the time. And people, when we talk about it, I ask them, hey, how are prices for you? You know, how are your groceries? How are your expenses? And they throw out a percentage figure. And I tell them what the government says is the official number for like household costs or food or energy. And they're like, no way, I'm paying way more than that percentage higher. And so I think people are starting to see the disconnect between those government numbers, which are sanitized for political reasons in the real world. And that'll attract them to gold as well eventually.
Well, Adam, there's always hedonic adjustments that need to be made. You know, this is a changing market.
Of course, of course. I, on that point, Tom, just this past Friday, Good Friday, the government, U.S. government released its PCE, Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, which is Fed officials' favorite inflation gauge. And that one drives me crazy. You know, they're all bad, but the PCE, what they do is if they have a series rising in price, they'll take it out, just remove it. And there's really no justification for it. So the Fed guys like the PCE because they pull out the series that are rising. Mm-hmm. Oh, you don't like beef is rising? We'll just take beef out of the index. You know, it's crazy. And so
people have been switching to chicken.
It blows my mind. They can get away with this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Adam, you know, I have the privilege of diving deep into all of my guests' work every time I interview them. But I feel like I'm only, you know, ever getting a snapshot in time. I wanted to ask you, what is some of the most interesting or compelling pieces of research that you've come across, that you have unearthed, that made you maybe think differently about something, or, you know, just blown your mind in some way or another, that, you know, unfortunately I miss by only getting to speak to every one of you, let's say once a quarter or maybe twice a year?
Oh, interesting question. One thing that's really exciting to me, Tom, I don't write about much because I just don't have anything concrete on it, is, you know, I talk to a lot of young people. I've got a couple of middle-aged kids. They're deeply involved in competitive sports. So we're always around young people and coaches and refs and, you know, different families. And I talk to young people about Bitcoin quite often. And they really like digital assets. They like the concept of gold. So I really think for this next generation that physically backed digital gold currencies are going to be a big thing. Yeah, I don't know how to build one where you can have 100% assurance that the gold's really in a vault or keep it out of government's hands. You know, it's a lot harder than Bitcoin because there's no physical backing for Bitcoin, of course. But I think that this younger generation, and even between, you know, my generation, this youngest generation, there's going to be a huge demand for a digital gold currency, a Bitcoin-like tradable vehicle that is physically backed somewhere in the world. I think that's huge. I think the kids would love that. I think they, by kids, I mean young people, say under 25. I guess mm-hmm. I gotta be careful with that. But, you know, I just, digitally backed gold currencies have been really intriguing me for a long time. I haven't done much writing on it, but I read everything I can about it. And I just think that has huge potential to make gold easier to own for people. And I don't know how to secure the gold or make sure that there's no problems with it, no fraud, but someone will figure this out and it'll just be huge, I think, in the next 10, 20 years. I'm really excited about that.
Yeah. Having some of the pluses of Bitcoin, you know, being more fungible, more portable than traditional gold, you know, obviously it can be looked at from one hand or another as a plus or minus, right? Being less portable or being less transferable would, you know, in a lot of cases be a good thing and or a bad thing, right? If you need to travel across state lines, that can be a bad thing. But if you're, you know, looking at it from a theft perspective, that is going to be a good thing with gold. But, you know, having the best of both of those worlds combined, I think I would agree, is going to be a great synergy that will make gold possibly more usable even, right?
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, I think everybody should have physical gold investment in their portfolios. I talk about gold ETFs all the time. I personally have never owned gold ETF shares, Tom. I'd rather have physical gold in my own immediate possession. That's the way I feel comfortable. That's the way I was raised. You know, I don't want to own someone else's claim to gold. But when I go to Costco to buy my hamburger every week, I'd love to be able to do it in gold, because then the inflation wouldn't erode the value of my dollars. I'd love them to take, you know, 0.05 ounces of gold out of my account, or 0.1 or whatever the number is, to pay my bill for that. And there's just no way to do that with physical gold. It's not divisible enough. It's just not a good transaction thing. But gold is like the perfect money, the perfect physical money in the world, and has been for millennia. So I just think there's some digital solution that combines the elements of the best cryptocurrencies, physically backed by real gold, that's you know, people really believe is there, that really is actually there for people to transact in gold. I know governments would hate that and there's all kinds of problems, but that kind of thing just really excites me. Some way to use gold in day-to-day transactions in a crypto-like wrapper, you know, that's just great stuff.
Mm-hmm. Adam, as you're discussing, you know, gold and your love of Costco, did you ever buy any of the little bars from Costco?
You know, I was really intrigued. I read the articles about that, Tom, and I didn't. You know, being in this industry, I tend to understand when gold's high or low, and it wasn't at a deep trough then. And I've accumulated a lot of gold in the last 25 years by the grace of God, and so I didn't need to buy, but I was really intrigued by it. I heard they sold out within like a day or two, like online. So that was really interesting, because there's huge demand for gold. And that was at a time when sentiment wasn't that great for gold. It wasn't super low, wasn't super high, just kind of lukewarm, meh, you know. And so it was cool. Costco sells out of gold whenever they get it. But no, I haven't bought Costco gold yet, but I'd love to.
Yeah. Well, we'll look forward to you having a Costco 1 ounce bar next time we speak to you, Adam.
I'll hold it right up here when I get it, Tom. It'll be awesome.
It'll be funny if it has a hot dog stamped on it or something.
That would be perffect. Oh, my goodness. Great comment.
Excellent, Adam. Well, that's all I have for you today. Is there anything else you'd like to leave our audience with before we wrap up today?
You know, I just encourage your viewers, you know, people haven't liked gold and gold stocks for a long time, but we might be on the cusp of like a 10-year Super Bowl. Gold went up like 638% between, call it early 2000 and late 2011, 638%. The gold stocks of the main index, the Huey, almost tripled that, like 1638%. These numbers might not be exact, Tom, but they're close. And so I just encourage people to look into gold and gold stocks. You don't have to go crazy. You don't have to own everything in gold, but consider putting 2-5% of your liquid assets in gold. Consider, you know, a 5% to 20% allocation in gold stocks, whether they're cheap. You know, it could be a life-changing wealth-building opportunity here as capital starts flowing into gold and this long overdue secular bull happens again. The opportunities are massive, just incredible here in the next decade.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more, Adam. Of course, all of your work is available at Zeal, Z-E-A-L. LLC.com. You put a lot of free material, and there's also some stuff that you do for paid subscribers, but you can check it all out there. Adam, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Great chatting with you as always.
Absolutely.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.